Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
My name's Claire Richards. I'm an architect, and a couple of years ago I founded a small not-for-profit organisation called Footwork, which is interested in helping to create successful communities.
Our guest this week is the architect Claire Richards. Claire took an unusual route into architecture. Following a successful television career as a documentary filmmaker, focusing on difficult social and societal problems, in her mid-40s she took the bold decision to change direction, enrolling at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London. She went on to develop her experience of working in collaboration with local communities. Indeed, in 2010, she won the RABA President's Medal for her dissertation, Happy Communities. Since qualifying as an architect in 2012, she's chosen an equally unusual path, working on a range of projects, often in close collaboration with residents and local communities. She recently founded Footwork, a not-for-profit company with an ambitious aim to ensure that clear social principles underpin all development and regeneration. I started by asking Claire about her unique experience of learning from two separate professions, both undergoing periods of rapid change.
Yes, I think there is a connection between the fact that I worked in a medium, I suppose, that was undergoing change. I'm sure there's a connection between that and the way that I have found myself working as an architect. Because I think that, I mean, I wasn't forced to make a change because the way media is now produced was changing. But there came a point where the kind of work that I had been doing over a period of about 15 years or so, I suppose that I had done some of the things I was keen to do. There was a proliferation of channels, and the way in which I was going to work was going to have to change, and I felt, fine, I could either do that, or I could say, here's an opportunity to do some of the other things that I'm...
A big change rather than a kind of... Yeah, and I think it's probably then the time for us to jump back and to talk about some of that earlier work first. And, I mean, TVAM is almost certainly an iconic brand and iconic building. You know, there's quite a kind of an interesting story around that. But maybe just first, it'd be interesting if you'd tell us a bit about your work, well, at TVAM and journalism more broadly. I mean, how did you become a journalist and how did you a TV producer?
Well, I became a journalist, a television journalist, I suppose. I was never a journalist in the news sense.
Right.
No, my ambition...
I mean, that's interesting in itself. I mean, you kind of defining what a journalist is and working... Yeah, as a journalist, I mean, it's almost, yeah, it's interesting. The term journalist is not protected in the UK, but the term architect is quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's a side. That is an interesting distinction because actually when TVAM began, they were looking for two types of employee because it was something new. We never had breakfast television. And the intention was that it was to be a live three-hour program. Nobody had tried anything quite so brave, frankly, as doing that. And also 7 days a week.
Yeah.
So they were looking for either people who had worked in television who could, I suppose, be trained to work in a what was essentially a news but a popular entertainment, fast-moving environment. But also for people who'd worked in as journalists in news, in newspapers, who could then be trained to work in television. And, I mean, I'll never forget, I had a history of art degree. I had been working as a contract researcher at BBC Television, desperate to get into music and arts programmes. It was never quite happening. You had to negotiate for your next programme, you know, when you made your last. I talked my way in through religious programmes, thinking rightly that that might be a slightly easier way in. And so when it came to TVAM, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I'm going to appear a little bit highbrow for this.
A popular entertainment programme.
A popular entertainment programme. And I came in and I was interviewed by an ex-BBC producer called Hilary Lawson, who sat me down and said, "So, Claire, what is art?"
and then stopped.
Completely floored by this. I mean, I can't even remember. I think I was so shocked I can't even remember what I replied. But anyway, it was obviously adequate. But so... I mean, the thing about TVAM was it was a fantastic training ground, because one moment you were working on a chat show with Michael Parkinson, Parky as we knew him. You might be working on a serious political program with David Frost. You might be working on news. You might be working in entertainment.
And this was, I mean, for people maybe from kind of overseas, TVAM in the UK was the first real kind of breakfast television. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine now, 4 terrestrial TV channels at the time and no breakfast programming. You know, the franchises were just kind of afternoon, evening.
Yes, we're talking about 1982.
Yeah, which was when TVAM was launched. Yeah,
and sounds a long time ago now, but of course, breakfast time, the BBC equivalent, started at exactly the same time.
Right.
So there was this sort of competition
for the first time, really, that kind of independent television coming on and launching something, and it was launched with an amazing new building design, postmodern building by Terry Farrell.
Egg Cup House.
Yeah.
As it was known.
In Camden. So it kind of will be known, I guess, to a lot of architects listening, as quite a seminal building in London for its... And was that notable for you at the time, working in a kind of... I mean, was that...
Oh, it was seriously cool.
Yeah.
I was in my early 20s and... to me, it was unbelievably exciting. And it was a proper job, proper contract. I was an employee. And there were 200 of us when it started. I think it built up to about 300.
Okay.
And you were just thrown in.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, actually, it was probably the only... sort of initiation that I then later had for going to the Bartlett to study architecture, because it was unbelievably scary.
Yeah.
And one moment you were out there, you were sent out with a camera crew to record an interview with somebody when you had never, ever done that. Nobody sat us down and said, "Let's train you as a reporter." You just did it. But I found quite quickly that I was much more comfortable behind the camera. And, I mean, I have always... I mean, it sounds a bit of a cliche now, but I've always been interested in people.
Yeah.
I was and I am very interested in narratives and, you know, why people do things, where they come from. Yeah. And so if, you know, one of the things I did quite often was produce phone-in programmes.
Right. Okay.
With people from all around the country phoning in about different issues. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And gradually I became much more involved in the more in-depth programming. And that sounds a bit of a contradiction in terms for TVAM.
Yeah.
but I might find myself, for instance, being sent out to, or you know, you would generally come up with your own ideas and then hope to do them. So I found myself looking at how the city of Atlanta dealt with inner city problems like homelessness, and then did the same in Newcastle and Liverpool, and we would run those stories across a week.
Yeah. And quite, I mean, for TVAM, quite a kind of interesting way of engaging a broad audience with interesting stories. This wasn't, you know, maybe you get now the kind of siloed, those sorts of stories siloed off onto BBC Four for a BBC Four audience and not kind of challenging a mainstream audience with quite challenging stories.
The intention was to engage as wider audiences as possible, which I don't think had been the aim up until that point. No. And when Greg Dyke came in as to save TVAM, yeah. TVAM was saved at least three times.
Yeah. And by people who told everyone else they'd saved it, yeah.
Exactly. And actually, Greg Dyke was fantastic.
Yeah.
He would always sit down in the morning meeting and said, well, would my mum listen to that?
Yeah.
And would a working class, you know, his words, family sit down and listen to this and would reject topics, but not the topics you might expect, not the serious news topics necessarily, because people are interested in these things. So, yes, very broad.
And then your route, I guess, film a little bit comes more maybe into people's imagination of architecture. That, where did that come from? I'm always interested in how people get exposed to architecture or to thinking about buildings, or to your parents aren't architects. There wasn't a route in there.
Well, my interest in architecture, I think, came through an interest in art and 3D art. I'd been very lucky that at my school, up until what was then O-levels, had a fantastic art teacher. And there was no such thing as a distinction between 2D and 3D art.
Right. Okay.
We had a go at everything. Yeah. Yeah. So when I was learning how to draw and how to be creative, it was quite a broad thing. And in terms of my family background, there are a lot of artists.
Right. Okay.
And so my grandfather was an artist. He grew up in Sunderland, the son of a technician in a iron casting company, and he learnt technical drawing, and he showed talent, and he ended up getting a scholarship to the Royal College of Art.
Wow.
Okay. And came down to London, met my grandmother, who was also an art student, and so art has always
been that kind of
been there in my background. Yeah. It's always been very considered very important by my parents and by my family.
Okay, because you did with some thought about being an architect quite early on.
It is absolutely true. I did make an attempt,
right.
A brave attempt to study architecture. I went to two all-girls schools.
Right.
And very early on, you were steered either towards the arts or you were steered towards the sciences. And I loved art. I was artistic. I loved music. History, English, and there seemed, by the time I was about 13 or 14, there seemed no question about doing any kind of science.
Right.
There wasn't a national curriculum, you know, if we wanted to drop science, you drop science. And maths, I have to say, I was crap at maths. I think I got my O-level maths the second time with, you know, lowest possible mark.
Yeah.
and moved, oddly enough, in the sixth form into a very academic school in Oxford, the Oxford High School. And I think they took one look at me and said, well, there's only a couple of things you're fit for, really. Which was, actually, I did English, art, and languages and French. And that was fine. But around about that time, I thought, this is a problem. I want to be an architect. I began to look at what was required. It was evidence, maths and physics were going to be required. And I got a place at Bristol to read a history of art at French.
Yeah.
I was very young. I finished school at 16 and I thought, well, I'll take a gap year, which that wasn't very fashionable then either, but I took a gap year. And I thought, well, I wonder if I go up to my local Poly, which is the Oxford Poly, which I knew had an architecture school, and had a word with them, whether they would let me try. I mean, you couldn't do this now. Architecture for a couple of terms. And then if I don't like it...
I'll do something. Yeah.
I was very young.
Yeah.
So I phoned them up.
Yeah.
They sort of said, well, you come along and have a conversation with us. I was ushered in to see this guy called Reggie Cave. I later realised that as a teacher, he was a bit of a legend. So we had a chat, and the chat wasn't about, as far as I can remember, about architecture at all. I mean, he might have said, what's your favourite building?
Yeah.
We talked about art and other things, particularly art. And then there came a time, and he said, well, I suppose we'd better, see whether you've got the potential to be an architect. And I was thinking, here we go, no maths, never heard of what a formula is, no maths, no science or physics of any kind. And he said, do you see there's a pile of bricks on the table here? And he said, there's a piece of paper, A4 paper. So what I want you to do is take these bricks, and I want you to bridge some of these bricks with this piece of paper in such a way as you can support one brick between them. And I looked at this, and into my head sprang, oh, okay, well, I know what I need to do here. I'll concertina this piece of paper and just hope for the best.
Yeah.
This probably won't work. So I took two bricks, another two bricks, put this concertina paper across the top, bunged the brick on, and was surprised as anybody that the whole thing didn't collapse. And he said, oh, well, that's fine then. We start next week.
And that was it.
And that was it.
Wow.
Completely mad.
Yeah, if only that was still possible.
Well, I mean, there's a serious conversation to be had there about who and how you get selected to lead architecture.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that a bit later. I'm quite interested in that subject. Yeah. And I absolutely love the design aspects of it. But you see, in those days, I mean, technology modules, I mean, we literally had maths lessons.
Within the physics, within the architecture degree.
Within the department, within the architecture department, there were maths lessons.
Right.
Technology was all applied physics, which of course it is.
Yeah.
It was self-evident after a couple of terms. I could go on enjoying myself, but there was no way I was going to pass an exam.
In maths. Yeah.
Or in technology.
That's maybe what I'm saying about the kind of difference in how maths is taught now, rather than teaching, pure maths in an abstract kind of academic context without any form of real world application, maybe is just harder. Yeah, it's just different.
I think it is harder, but I also think it does, go back to the question of who is selected to read architecture, to study architecture.
So I wanted to come on then on to, I know we're supposed to be a podcast about architecture, but I wanted to come on to the storytelling and the television production. Straight out of university then, you said somewhere, wangled a job, talked your way into a job in the BBC. How did...
Yes, I certainly wasn't going to manage to get into the BBC via the normal route at that time, which, frankly, if you weren't an Oxbridge student, you weren't going to get onto a training scheme. And
That's interesting. We're not the only profession with a problem with diversity and a problem with access. And
that was unquestionably the case with television.
Yeah,
very sort of hierarchical kind of world.
Yeah. So, it was for you a calculated decision. That would be an easier or an interesting way in. What was that?
Needs must.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to get in to television.
But you had decided that's what you wanted. You were. Where did the television gem of an idea come from?
While I was at university, I began to think that one way to further my interest in art was to produce arts documentaries.
Right.
And I think in going into television, I don't think I was, at that stage even, I don't think I was just interested in content. I was very interested in the creative aspects of, potentially, of directing television programmes. Had this ambition, the likelihood of achieving it, I would imagine, that stage wasn't great. But the only way I found, the only connection I had to television was through the fact that my father was an academic.
Right.
He was a philosopher of religion in Oxford. And he had connections with the religious affairs department.
Right.
And he said, look, I'm sure somebody could talk to you. And in those days, you could go and talk to people. I mean, now...
Much more accessible.
Yeah. Much more accessible. And why not? So he said, this is the guy's name, you know, write to him, which I did.
Yeah.
And he was good enough to say, come and have a chat, and said, oh, well, we got an interesting series beginning. We're doing a series about the Easter story, and we're looking for a researcher, so why don't you come and work on that? And it was as easy as that. I suppose that was the beginning of something else that has proved useful, certainly in my television career, which was an ability to talk your way in to doing things.
Yeah. And interesting, I mean, that idea of talking your way into things, I mean, it's kind of interesting how that ability to earn trust, you know, to persuade people to speak on camera and to comes into architecture, you know, in terms of consultations and in terms of liaising with clients and in terms of, that's quite an important skill that's maybe not taught in architecture school.
I think that is an important skill, and it's something that you're not taught really as a, I mean, there's no mechanism to formally learn these things in television either. I mean you can now go and do a degree in media, you certainly couldn't then. And I think that I learned quite quickly that through that if you want to engage somebody to participate in something, that the only way to do that is to be open and honest and to meet people on a level. And that is definitely the case. That in my particular case, when it came to making television programs, I was particularly interested in telling the story behind what I considered to be very superficial headlines. And in order to do that, first of all, there was a research process by which you had to find out what the real story was. So that was the fundamental narrative element. What is this story behind the headlines? And then how are you going to find those individuals who are going to bring that alive, who are going to, if you like, put the record straight?
And so, jumping back then, you then decided to leave TVAM to set up, again, quite an interesting story about setting up your own independent production company. Kind of transition, how, I mean, what was the route?
So I had at the back of my head that to become an independent producer, where I would have a little bit more control over the subjects that I was dealing with, would be interesting. And then something happened that had, one of those things that just had a huge, huge impact on my life and family, in that my second child, Harriet, died as a cot death at just a month old. And, you know, oddly enough, I had been working with Anne Diamond, who lost a child as a result of cot death just a few months earlier. It was an extraordinary thing. And, of course, anybody would know that that life just doesn't go on as you might have planned it, if something like that happens in your life. And quite apart from the emotional impact is the fact that the world takes on a very, very different perspective.
Yeah.
And the material world becomes much less important. And you focus much more on what you believe to be important, your family, your relationships. When I was able to pick myself up sufficiently to think what I was going to do, the idea of making sort of narrative-led documentaries on predominantly social issues became very important.
And had more meaning.
Yeah. Popular entertainment was probably something that I wasn't by that stage going to pursue. So I initially started up with a friend who had been an independent producer for a while, so that I could just gain a bit of experience.
And that, in a sense, is quite similar to the story about people starting their own architecture firms often. I mean, there's a kind of starting a business and starting, you know, the kind of comfort of starting with a partner or with a friend rather than going it completely alone and having someone to bat ideas off and having someone to kind of second.
Definitely starting up a small independent production company is very brave. Financially very, very brave. You fly by the seat of your pants. Yeah. You are only as good as the commissions that you can manage to get. Yeah. And commissions were about developing a relationship with commissioning editors, which at the beginning, of course, you don't have.
No.
So the fact that it is on a project-by-project basis, that, of course, is a similarity. But independent production companies, the way certainly I started out and most started out, were by employing people on a freelance basis. So it was only once you had a commission, and therefore a budget in place,
that you
would take on the team to make the program.
Okay.
And then once you had transmitted a successful program, then the chances of getting another one were a little bit easier, and it went on like that.
Okay. Pillarbox Productions was the company, and kind of social throughout the 15 years of the company, social stories more than
Yes, I mean, as an independent producer, my particular interest was in telling these stories behind the news headlines. It was very much a combination of research, what is the true story, what is the real story, and then how am I going to form a narrative to tell that story. And it was unashamedly, I think, about the message, because I suppose I would have called myself a campaigning documentary filmmaker. At that time, there were a lot of seasons on, particularly BBC Two or BBC One and Two, I suppose, and Channel Four, and I became quite involved in determining what those seasons would be. So a season on poverty, for which I made a series on different types of poverty, in which I filmed in urban communities, rural communities, different age groups, how poverty affected families, the elderly. So those were the kinds of subjects that I was involved with.
So I was interested then, Pillarbox Productions, there came a point when you thought, I've tried to be an architect once, I'm going to try to be an architect again. What was the kind of change? A big transition there, to think.
I'm quite sort of counter-suggestible, really.
Right.
And if people set about telling me I can't do something, then I tend to think, why?
Yeah. Says who? Yeah, who says you?
And I think my interest in becoming an architect actually partly goes back to the fact that this was something that I'd had a little bit of a taste of and thought perhaps I had a potential for, but had never been able to...
To kind of fulfil the...
Progress. In fact, there were two other aspects, but one was that by this stage I had filmed in many, many different types of communities, and I had been immersed over a period of time in the stories that people had to tell about the context in which they were living. And I was aware that that seemed to be something to do with the built environment in which they lived. I don't think I had developed any kind of clear idea about this, but instinct told me that there must be a connection between the fabric of a failing estate in Hartlepool, where, you know, every third house was boarded up, and the very difficult issues that the people living there were encountering. And, I mean, that might sound very simplistic, but that was the story that I was being told. And so I was interested to know why these communities were failing. So that was a second element. And I think a third element was that I had been very fortunate to make the kinds of programs that I wanted to make. And the proliferation of channels was just beginning. And I realized I was going to have to change the way in which I was making television programs. Big Brother had arrived, reality TV had arrived. And this wasn't the medium that I was interested in using. And I could have continued. And there's something slightly bizarre about closing down a successful production company. So I sort of did a little gamble with myself, if you like. I said to myself, well, if an architecture school wants me, I might want it, because the chances of anybody taking me is going to be extremely small. Why would they? Here was I was in my early 40s then, with three children, a television producer. I already knew I didn't have the basic qualifications. And I didn't have the opportunity to go very far from home, and I was living in Islington. And so I looked around me.
The Macintosh School of Architecture certainly wasn't top of the list. No.
Even if I had wanted to. And I had to have a negotiation with my husband, really. I knew enough and had enough friends who were architects to know that doing an architecture training was going to be all-consuming. You know, I had three children, the youngest of whom was nine.
Right, so still not completely independent as kids.
If I was to go to university, my son was eldest son was going to start at the same time.
Wow, okay.
And so I looked around me and I thought, oh, UCL seems to have a good architecture school called the Bartlett. Why don't I try there? So I applied and was somewhat surprised, given my basic qualification, when I was invited to an interview with Bob Scheel.
Still the head of department.
He now is. He certainly wasn't
then. Okay.
He wasn't then. And I just went along and had a nice chat. It wasn't so very different, I suppose, to the first.
You weren't asked to do things. I've done this test before with my paper and concertina bricks. There wasn't that test. No.
No. So I was invited along. I vividly remember him saying, "Well, it's always really interesting to throw somebody into the mix who's just going to."
The wild card is
just going to throw in something completely different. Your interest in communities and the potential impact, I suppose, of the built environment is something that it might be interesting to include to have a bit of. So
I mean, I suppose that's a thought about how students learn from other students they're surrounded by, and actually having a slightly more diverse mix of students is perhaps a positive thing.
Well, all I had to show for myself were a few film clips, an A-level art portfolio, which I had kept for some reason. Perhaps there was something at the back of my mind. And, you know, this is what I produced. But I think, you know, there was an interest in throwing a mature student, somebody who was, you know, in their early 40s, into the mix. And so when he said, right, we'll take you, I said, okay then.
Yeah. It's the decision made by someone else. Yeah, that's quite, I think there's, I forget who else we were speaking to recently talked about some of the decisions you make yourself and some of the decisions you allow others to make for you. And that's...
This was definitely one of those. And to be honest, had I known, you know, had I had the benefit of foresight to understand quite how
the reputation of the
and how difficult it was going to be. So it might have been interesting to throw me into the mix. But for me, landing in that environment with 18 and 19 year olds. There were two other mature students. One was 35. She'd been in advertising. And then there was another mature student of 25. But I have to say that in all of that time at the Bartlett, I was never treated as anything other than an equal team member. One of the things of being thrown into the horror of unit life, or indeed the first year, even at the Bartlett, was you were all in it together. You were all thrown in it together. There was no question of who is this person? Where do they come from? You were all in there.
You've got too many other things to worry about, I suppose, than that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've finished at the Bartlett. I was very proud of my 2-2.
Yeah.
I was fairly shocked that although I survived, in a cohort of 150, half dropped out.
Wow. Over the 3 years.
Over the 3 years.
And what was the...
Well, that's an interesting issue. Yeah. And I think architecture, when I ask around now, architecture students, I still think there's a shockingly high dropout rate. Partly there were quite a lot of international students who were paying a great deal to come. And I think, you know, there were some where this was a mutual agreement and people weren't making the grade, but there were others where the stress was phenomenal. And in some cases, I don't think there was always a level of understanding of the difficulties that very young students confront. And, you know, architecture school shouldn't be about breaking people's spirits.
No, it's not the military, is it?
It's
not
about it should be about providing the support that will enable people to thrive in what was a very competitive environment and to do their best.
That's kind of slightly depressing, maybe, how little some of that's changed from your first visit to Oxford Poly and the kind of lack of support there to still there being that.
I would worry about advising young people to study architecture unless they had some form of support network around them and had a degree of self-confidence, because I saw that self-confidence thrashed out of talented young people, and I found that quite scary. In other areas, they were very supportive, and I wouldn't like to convey a sense that that was what the Bartlett was like. As I say, I mean, overall, in my 3 years, I found actually that there was quite a lot of support, but then I had a lot of life experiences that I had to deal with.
You had your own network and you had your, the experiences previous.
When I was thinking of changing to architecture and trying to decide whether to apply to study architecture, I consulted any friends that I had
who were architects.
And one particular individual who will remain nameless because of this story, but who runs a very successful architecture practice, said to me, "Oh, I wouldn't do it if I were you."
Advised you not to train to become as a mature student. Yeah.
Advised me not to do it at sort of my time in life as much as anything else. And when I asked why, he said, because there's no way that I would offer a job to a 45-year-old, newly qualified, in inverted commas or brackets, female architect. I mean, he may not have said female architect. I may be embroidering this story, but I remember feeling that that was implied. Yeah.
Well, it was either ageist or ageist and sexist, but either way, it's not a good indictment of the profession.
Yeah. Absolutely right. And indeed, when I did go to architecture school, I was quite shocked by the fact that how undiverse it was. And that is something that we really do need to address.
Yeah. You must have been shocked at the time.
I was very shocked.
Yeah.
I was very shocked by that.
By someone you knew as well.
But just all the more determined. Yeah. And I have to say that I have met no ageism at all in any of the places that I either applied to or worked.
I mean, I suppose that's the thing. Am I making things up here? But presumably was wrong in terms of, what would be more depressing is if you had come out of architecture school and he had been right, that you had not managed to get any job. So I suppose there is a something there that, it seems to be.
He was definitely wrong.
Yeah. So you worked then, finished at the Bartlett, had a year out, and then worked, you did your part two at Westminster, stayed in. Still not in a position to be able to move to Sheffield or to the Macintosh, but Westminster for part two, and quite a different university, maybe Westminster, do you think?
Well, Westminster had then and still has a very good reputation for diploma.
Yeah.
And I knew enough by then to be able to apply somewhere that I felt lived in the real world in a way that I felt perhaps the stage that I was there at the Bartlett didn't.
Yeah.
And that proved to be right. Yeah. And it was a much more collaborative process. One of the most basic things, you chose your studio. They didn't choose you. Sounds similar, but it isn't. It's completely different. So there wasn't a sense, you are not good enough to be in this unit. You will have to take your third choice unit. There's none of that.
That's how it's taught at the Bartlett.
That's how it was at the Bartlett. Wow. You would put down your three choices and they would choose you.
Yeah.
And I found myself, was able to choose, fortunately, to be in Jean Sillett's Studio 12, which was very much grounded in the real world and in narratives. Yeah. And I found a natural home.
Right.
And so I thrived there in a way that I hadn't. Yeah. And transformed my perspective on how really I wanted to be an architect. And that was partly through the history dissertation that you had to do. I had lurking at the back of my mind this question of the extent to which the built environment is relevant in creating successful communities, or where you are in a terrible built environment contributing to their failure.
And that was the kind of early days of footwork kind of being formed there.
Yes.
Really, those kind of ideas coming through.
Yes, those ideas coming through and being aware that nobody was really addressing them. I say nobody. We know, of course, that there are socially aware developers, there are architecture practices that have been doing some very interesting things over that time. But I would say, as a generality, and particularly as the pressure to provide affordable housing, the interest in building new towns, the corridor between Oxford and Cambridge, for example, where existing communities will be swamped by new development, I feel, as an architect, very strongly that we are beholden to set about that in a way that is going to bring value to those communities and not destroy them. The question is, how do we do it?
Yeah. Your first experience then of, say, being an architect or of doing architecture work, to an outsider, maybe architecture, there are some parts, to someone who's not an architect, that seem very much about high-level problem-solving. I guess the day-to-day work of architecture is often about detailing and small details. And is that fair to say, do you think? Or is that something you found enjoyable? Or
I think one of the most enjoyable things about architecture as a profession is that it is so multifaceted. Mm. I mean, there's some wonderful examples, like Peter Barber's home's place. For instance, where there's a wonderfully elegant solution that's providing for homeless people. It's small, but you sort of feel it's perfectly formed. Or on a much larger scale, the way that Urban Splash and Studio Egret West, for instance, have been redeveloping Park Hill in Sheffield. You know, they're... These are ways in which very good creative design comes together with an awareness of these other aspects of architecture. Mm-hmm. So as an individual, when I went into an architecture office, I don't separate those things out.
No. Okay.
But I sat down with everybody else, and used CAD, and I was doing the door details and itching to have just something small to design. The last practice that I worked with, in fact, the last two practices that I worked with, I did some very interesting things that I think bring these things together. One was on what is now called New Ground, the older women's co-housing project in Barnet, which I think is now is quite a high profile.
Won awards, I think.
I think it has. And so I was working at Pollard Thomas Edwards at the beginning of that process, and I wanted to work there because they've done some very interesting
a reputation
work.
For a lot of estate work on estates.
Work on estates with older people as well, and I was very interested. So here, this is where the design and the idea comes together. And the client was the older women co-housing. And they wanted to engage in a collaborative design process, which is something that Pollard Thomas Edwards hadn't done before, and certainly I hadn't. So we devised that from scratch. And I really loved that. Sort of, I, at the beginning of that process, took the lead on that, and we were dealing with a blank piece of paper. So that was fascinating.
With people who had not been involved in a design process
Never.
Before. Right.
And so... going to this, a bald site in Barnet where the building had already been raised to the ground and talking from the basic principles. How does this site engage with the community, the street outside? How do you want it to engage? It was a group of women over, I believe, the age of 55, but somewhere in their 80s, who had decided they wanted to live together. And they were supported by a developer. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to fund this. And it took them years to find the site and to make this happen. Mm. And now there's a lot of interest in co-housing of this kind. And in fact, since then, through Footwork, I've become involved in a couple of others, and I'm involved in editing. We're editing a guide to collaborative design for use both by self-builders and other groups and architects, because having gone through the process, we learned a lot. So PTE is one of the authors. And I then worked at Fluid, Fluid Architects, two halves of the same company, in which the soundings aspect does all that research and that ground level collaborative work that I sort of felt was so important and was really attracted to that. And the project that I worked on there was a massive meanwhile project called Industrious for the Olympics. Right. Where again, Fluid won a competition with Newham, and we had to fundraise £200,000 worth of goods in kind, and collaborated with the local community. Of course, where was the local community? Mm. Huge vacant site. But we learned a lot, and I think Newham learned a lot from that process.
On the kind of Olympic fringe. Yeah.
So although I was doing some of these more standard things. Yeah. I was very fortunate to be involved in some really quite exciting, if slightly scary, projects for my sort of stage of experience.
I think a lot of people we've spoken to have said that about just the kind of making of them as architects really being trusted. I mean, you've got, you know, being given a responsibility, you feel you have to live up to it, as being quite transformative for a lot of architects, I think, that whether that's being lucky in a practice or whether that's kind of earning that trust, either way, it's still a phenomenal
I think that is a very important part of your architecture training, is finding yourself in a situation where you are thrown in into the deep end. And when you look at the competences that you have had to have acquired to pass part three, it would frighten any very experienced architect. You look at this and think, goodness me, you know, how in a lifetime of being an architect would I do this? I mean, it is true that by the time I qualified, I knew very well that I wasn't going to be able to climb up some hierarchy. You know, when by that time, you know, you're over 50 and, you know, you don't
but
have
that presumably wouldn't ever have appealed, would it, the idea of going into a big corporate practice and kind of climbing the corporate ladder in a
I was very happy to be in those practices to learn.
Right.
Okay. I was very happy to be making coffee with, you know, the other part ones because you learn.
But in terms of trajectory, in terms of that's clear, you know.
No, in terms of a trajectory, I was always going to have to work for myself in the same way that I had as a television producer. Once you've had a taste of running your own business, I think it's quite difficult.
So go back into
As that. I say, I work collaboratively very happily. That's the way I would do it. But I don't think I'm very easily employable in the traditional sense.
I was talking to John McCaslin the other day, who said... he was talking about his various partnerships that he's been through, and he said, well, I'm happily married, and there's one partnership in my life, and that's the one partnership, and I'm on my own ship now, which I thought was quite an interesting and honest answer. And there are I suppose people to take that. I think many of the people I've spoken to actually who've taken that jump to launch their own practice have said they're unemployable in the nicest way, really, that if you've got that boldness and that ability to deal with that scary approach to setting up your own firm or your own organisation is quite a...
It's partly scary. It also, you know, it's a huge privilege because you can't do that unless you're in a position to do it. Mm. And, you know, without a husband and a family who are supportive... of that, but it means that in the time that I now have to practice, and of course I hope to go on for a long time, I can choose to do that in the way that I believe I might be most effective. And so if I want to make a noise about something, making a noise is what I will do. Yeah. And that's fantastic
opportunity.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Claire Richards. You can find out more about Claire and her work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.